Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Ead, Judge Riley, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today, July 24, 2024, we have four matters that are scheduled for oral argument. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the first case, please.
The first case is A23-1379. State of Minnesota Respondent versus Larry Rucker Appellant.
Counsel, you're both familiar with appellate process. Just a reminder, you each have 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief, and if you go over that, I'll certainly call it to your attention. The podium also has an up and down button if you need to adjust it for your height. Appellant counsel, you always have 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please remember to state your name and introduce which party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. When you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Stacy Bettison, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Larry Rucker. This is an extraordinary case, one that presents several serious and troubling errors that require Mr. Rucker's convictions be vacated or that Mr. Rucker be granted a new trial. The number one issue that I'll start with is self-defense. Mr. Rucker asserted self-defense, and the state did not, because they could not disprove any single element of the claim. There is no evidence that was presented at trial that disproved the any element.
So essentially, you're arguing sufficiency of the evidence as far as a conviction, right?
That's how I understand the self-defense. They need to disprove, and there was insufficient evidence to disprove any one of the elements. We can look to the prosecutor's own words in closing argument, which we outline in our brief at reply at 3, to understand what they believed their evidence was that disproved all the elements of self-defense, and there was nothing in there that disproved the elements of self-defense. Now, in this appeal, as contrasted to trial, the state's theory that it did disprove beyond a reasonable doubt self-defense seems to be twofold. Number one, that DB, the victim, was the aggressor. We are not clear why the state would argue this now, seeing as how the trial court specifically found that DB was the aggressor and departed downward in sentence. Moreover, it's irrelevant to whether the state has proved any element of self-defense. How a person...
I was going to ask you a question looking at page 3 of your reply brief.
Yes.
You outline various parts of the self-defense claim, and one of the things that the state pointed to was that DB never fired his weapon. You say it's irrelevant. Why is that irrelevant?
He procured a stolen weapon after having some sort of engagement with Mr. Rucker and Mr. Watts. He left that engagement, procured a weapon, and started walking fast towards them with his weapon in his right hand. That in and of itself presents a threat.
Brandishing the weapon is what you're saying. You acknowledge he didn't fire. The evidence disproved that he fired a weapon.
At that point, he had not attempted to fire. After the initial shot was fired and then two more, he raised his weapon and charged towards Mr. Rucker and Mr. Watts.
Don't you think it has something to do with the reasonableness of the force that Mr. Rucker used, whether or not DB fired the weapon?
I'm sorry, can you ask the question again?
Well, your brief, to Judge Riley's point, states that DB never fired his weapon and that's irrelevant. Don't you think that it might be relevant to whether or not the force that Mr. Rucker used was reasonable under the circumstances?
It would be our position that when a gun is pointing at you, that it is reasonable to defend yourself. Now, even the state admits that after the gun was pointed towards Mr. Rucker and Mr. Watts, that the fear was reasonable And they admit that in their brief, and so at that point, the reasonableness is met, and even the state conceded that. When he fired the final shot, which their theory is the fourth shot was the fatal shot.
And who fired the final shot?
When Mr. Rucker filed the fourth and final shot, it's the state's theory that that shot killed the victim. And they admit in their brief, at the point that the gun was pointed at Mr. Rucker, and then he fired the fourth shot, that the reasonableness, that reasonableness was present.
So, about the fourth shot, as I understand the facts, Rucker's companion fired the first shot.
That's correct. And
And then there were the two shots fired, and then by Rucker, and then Rucker fired the final shot after, as you say, the victim was coming at him.
Yes, but the victim was coming at them before any shot was fired, just to be clear.
Okay.
Right.
So then my question is, why isn't witness McCarroll's testimony direct evidence that the fourth shot is the shot that struck the victim when the witness testified that he heard a shot and then watched the victim go down immediately after that?
Right. So thank you, Your Honor. The direct evidence would be he heard a fourth shot and he saw the victim fall. There's no direct evidence there that the fourth shot penetrated the victim. That's the inference.
Can I interrupt for one moment? It looks like the timer hasn't started.
Oh my goodness, I'm sorry, and I'm presiding.
My fault?
Yeah, if you'll put it started at 10.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Eade. Right.
Yes, thank
you. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Where were we? I'll just say.
The fourth shot, you were describing the fourth shot as not necessary.
Oh, yes, it's not. Right, it's not direct evidence. The witness, let's be very clear, the witness never said, I saw him get shot. What he said was, I heard shots, and then I saw the victim shoot, which he didn't because the victim never got a shot off.
Right.
But so he says, I saw him shoot, and then he heard a fourth shot, and then he saw the victim fall. So the direct evidence is he saw him fall, he saw him try to shoot, and that he heard the fourth shot. The inference is that the fourth shot penetrated the victim, but that's just an inference that is, you know, it's one of the inferences, and that's our other argument, is that the sufficiency of the actual elements of the crimes is not met because the other reasonable inference, and we have to have this unerringly, you know, point to guilt. There is another shooter. There's a second shooter, and there is no forensic evidence that, no direct forensic evidence that tied guns to bullets to casings to Mr. Rucker.
Can I ask you a question about that? So say we agree with you that the circumstantial evidence standard applies in the way that you've argued. It's sometimes concerning to me there's a difference between the statement that we consider the circumstances proved by the state, and then more recently it seems like the Supreme Court is using a narrower language that we winnow down the evidence presented at trial to a subset of facts that is consistent with the jury's verdict. The former seems to sweep in more circumstances proved. The latter, if we're applying just the narrow subset of facts that's consistent with the jury's verdict, would knock out a lot of the circumstances that it would seem to me you would like us to look at in deciding that there's a reasonable inference that does not point to guilt. And so what I mean by that is when I look at the list of circumstances proved in your brief, and I consider just the circumstances that point to guilt, it gets a lot. That narrow subset of facts is a lot smaller. It's, you know, that the fourth and final shot undisputedly came from Mr. Rucker, that the witness heard that shot, that Mr. Rucker fell, that a bullet pierced the victim's aorta. None of the other information supports the verdict that you'd like us to consider, like someone could continue running down the street with a bullet in them. So what is your take on that? What is the, I mean, I'm assuming I know the answer, but it seems like the Supreme Court has more recently given us a much narrower focus than applying the circumstantial evidence standard.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question and one that I've thought about. If you know, I'm not sure what to do about the Supreme Court's recent winnowing down. What I can tell you is that there is expansive case law in Minnesota that has set out, and that's Al Nasir, that has and progeny that has set out how we look at circumstances proved. Now, yes, you're right that it does narrow it down. What I can tell you is that there was two shooters. And that there is another, I think the focus needs to be.
Can I interject again?
Yes, please.
Even the two shooters, right? The fact that the companion fired the first shot wouldn't necessarily be in that subset of facts that supports the verdict. So, you know, we have three shots fired by Mr. Rucker. And if we're applying strictly that subset of facts language, it seems a lot harder to get where you would like us to go. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, and I would also offer, and this may be against, you know, my client's interest to say this, but I will say it because I think it's transparent. I don't know any situation under which a sufficiency of the evidence argument would prevail with that narrow standard.
Well, it starts to merge with the direct evidence standard, right?
Right.
Once we're applying
it, it almost becomes a meaningless inquiry, and so that's why. You know, I guess I don't know how to answer that exactly in a way that resolves your question of, you know, we have this subset. I keep going back to, you know, what if we point unerringly to the circumstances or Mr. Rucker's guilt, we just can't do that because of the forensic evidence, the other shooter, and there's no direct evidence, period, that shot was the shot that killed the victim.
But you would agree as a matter of appellate procedure that given that we have recent statements from the Supreme Court with this winnowing standard, the best we could do is flag the distinction that you've you know, pointed out here. I mean, how can we get there if we're supposed to apply, like Gillian, you know, recently adopted that standard?
Right. I think that it's going to be a case by case, and this fact pattern is just fraught with the direct evidence here is nearly non-existent, and we just have this, you know, this dearth of really circumstantial evidence too that points unerringly to Mr. Rucker's guilt. If I could take a minute maybe to think about that and come back to that. It's such a fair question, and I thank you for it. If I could turn, importantly, to the prosecutorial misconduct, I feel like that needs a lot of attention because that prosecutorial misconduct went to both the sufficiency issue and it went to the self-defense claim. The prosecutor in closing argument repeatedly said that Mr. Rucker had a duty to retreat. The instruction was expressly taken out or was never given. The judge expressly said no. And the prosecutor continued to refer to his duty to retreat 16 times in closing, 5 times in rebuttal. Now, the state references a case from Colorado which actually supports our position, which is that sort of comment when you have no duty to retreat and referring to that throughout closing is error. It's plain error, and the state has admitted to several plain errors with the prosecutorial misconduct, and we know it's not harmless, and that's the important thing. That's where these claims, as you know, fail. But in this case, it is not harmless because it is very possible that the jury heard all the evidence, even believed Mr. Rucker and his testimony, the state would like to say, well, they obviously didn't believe him, but that they believed him and believed that he had a duty to retreat based on what the prosecutor continued to argue through closing. And that is not harmless error. And that is a significant piece of this whole case. And that's why I say this is an extraordinary case.
But because what do you make of, and I know you cited in your brief, but in Glowacki, the Supreme Court said that in all situations in which a party claims self-defense, even absent a duty to retreat, the key inquiry is still into the reasonableness of the use of force. So, I mean, I understand the argument was as to retreating, but what do you make of the idea that Mr. Rucker's failure to do something else other than fire the gun would fit into Glowacki's requirement that the jury needs to consider and the appellate court needs to consider whether force was reasonable under the circumstances, even absent a duty to retreat?
Sure, and I think that the inquiry is not what Mr. Rucker could have done. That's Fidel, and that's in our brief. The inquiry is what did he do, and was it reasonable? When there's a gun pointed at your face, is it reasonable to fire? Or do you have to wait until you're fired upon? That's the issue. When a gun is pointed at your face, do you get to do that? And the state concedes that once the gun went up and he fired the fourth shot, it was reasonable. And so Glowacki was on the instruction. Reasonable use of force is different than what the state is proposing, which is this general reasonableness. And I don't understand it, and maybe the state can provide more information, but there's no general reasonableness that I'm aware of. There's no rule. And so I don't, that's my answer to the Glowacki issue, and I'm out of time.
And you'll have your rebuttal.
Yep, thank you.
Period. And we'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Alexandra Meyer, and I'm appearing on behalf of the state. The crux of this case is appellant's testimony that the jury did not believe. An analysis of his testimony applies to all three of the issues here. If the jury had believed appellant's testimony, they would have found that he had proved all three elements of his self-defense claim. But the jury didn't believe him, and they had reasonable grounds upon which to reject that testimony. The standard of review here requires you to give great deference to the jury's credibility determinations. Appellant's testimony included that he thought multiple people were shooting, that he fired his gun because he believed people were shooting at him, that he fired into the air, that he shot away from the victim, that he fired his gun only to buy time and run away, and he claimed he was retreating the entire time. The jury didn't believe appellant's version of events, and rightly so. The state's evidence included eyewitness testimony about the victim being hit by the fourth shot, surveillance video disproving appellant's claim of retreating the entire time, video showing the victim with the gun at his side and not raised.
You eyewitness testimony about the victim being hit with the fourth shot. Your counterpart, I think, made a pretty compelling point that when you parse it, it really was, I heard the shot and then I saw him fall. I mean, can you respond to that? Do you disagree? The testimony was, I watched as the bullet entered?
The testimony was, I saw him get hit. So I think that is sufficient. And if you think from a practical perspective of what you would see if someone was hit by a bullet, that is obviously something an eyewitness could see the physical response to having been impacted by a projectile.
That's why you're arguing this is a direct evidence review.
Yes, because the jury received direct evidence that this fourth bullet was the bullet and the only bullet that hit the defendant. And under the Supreme Court's case law in Horst, you get to look at if there's direct evidence on each element. There can also be circumstantial evidence. But if there's direct evidence as to each element, then we're under the direct evidence standard of review.
I'm trying to remember the facts of the case. There were four casings or casings found. None of the victim's gun was found. The other guns were not found.
Correct.
So you couldn't do ballistics.
But you could show that three of the casings came from the same gun, and we know that Mr. Rucker fired three shots. So that is very convincing ballistic evidence. The investigator also testified that there was one casing that was off to the side, consistent with where the first shot was fired. And so the one shot there, or one casing in this location, three in the other, was very consistent with the state's theory.
I was curious if you think that there's one of the three elements of self-defense that you think is stronger for your case than the others.
I was thinking about that in preparing for this, and I believe that because there was so much evidence discrediting appellant's testimony, his subjective belief that he was in fear and that his reaction to that met that second element, I think that may be the state's strongest argument, but also that is really tied into the objective review by the jury looking at his circumstances. So between those two, but it is very clear the jury did not believe his testimony.
How do you respond to Glowacki? That's how you pronounce it.
So Glowacki is one of those cases that has some really great lines that we want to pull out and plug into our briefs, but what the court was doing there was very different than what this court is doing here when looking at the evidence here, insufficiency of the evidence. So I believe that Glowacki gives this court the ability to look at, even absence of duty to retreat, the overall reasonableness of the defendant's, the appellant's actions. And this ties into the prosecutor's repeated mention of retreat. This comes because the defendant himself testified that he was retreating, that his whole reason for shooting was his fear, that he was he's trying to back away, he's trying to buy time to get away. That was his testimony to the jury. So it is absolutely fair game for the prosecutor to mention this, because the jury is considering this based on the defendant's own testimony.
Do you agree with Ms. Bedenson's characterization of your argument that the state concedes it was reasonable for Mr. Rucker to fire the weapon at the point that the victim was running towards him with his gun raised?
I agree with it in the sense that if we're talking about who was the aggressor, we only have to disprove one of the elements of self-defense. So I can make alternative arguments, or the state can make alternative arguments, and that would really play into whether he was the aggressor or not. But the reasonableness of at what point he truly sees somebody with a gun raised, there is a point here where he does not have, where Mr. or DB does not have his weapon raised, and he is being shot at. So that is the context in which we're looking at the defendant's response being reasonable. Once he has had bullets actually hit him, once he's had bullets shot at him, we're in a different realm.
But it's kind of a fluid situation, though, right? I mean, what is your best argument, and what cases support this idea that we kind of freeze frame that point in time at the very beginning of the interaction when the victim's walking towards him and only view the evidence of aggression at that point? I mean, and also, like, I don't understand why, if you think it's reasonable for Mr. Rucker to fire his weapon when the victim's charging with his gun drawn, that wouldn't be relevant to elements two and three, the actual and honest belief that Mr. Rucker's in imminent danger and the existence of reasonable grounds for that belief. I mean, it seems pretty reasonable to me that if someone's running at you with a gun, you might be very afraid that you're about to be shot and you might shoot back, right? Why should we limit our use of that evidence to just the aggressor element?
So you're correct. This is a very fluid situation. And potentially both these individuals would have arguably a self-defense claim, because they're in a situation where there are guns and they're, they could try to raise a self-defense claim no matter who is shooting. But what we're looking at is the defendant's testimony about what he believed was happening is not consistent with him firing the second and third shots that are fired in a state where he, like, we have to look at all three shots. He is shooting.
Why is that true? I mean, we have video of the victim running at him with his gun drawn. Why is it not reasonable at that point? And why does whatever happened before somehow eliminate his self-defense argument, Mr. Rucker's self-defense argument, when the victim's charging at him with the gun?
If you look at the video very closely, or I would direct you to the video to answer this question, you can see the point at which the victim raises his gun, and it is after he's already been shot at three times. I think that's important in analyzing the reasonableness of Mr. Rucker shooting first.
Are there cases that say that if someone is the initial aggressor and then there's an interaction that follows for some period of time after that, the mere fact that they were their initial aggressor at the beginning of the incident is what precludes them from a valid self-defense claim?
I don't know of any, which is partially why this case is so confusing, and I'm arguing a case next week with the exact same issue. It is not clear who, at what point, what self-defense claim would end.
Would you agree one way that we could look at the evidence here is that at the beginning of the interaction, when the victim has his hands down and Mr. Rucker and his companion fires and Mr. Rucker fires two shots, Mr. Rucker doesn't have a valid self-defense claim. But at the point that the victim charges with the gun raised, Mr. Rucker might, because the circumstances have changed.
But if you're not the initial aggressor, you can't, what's the case law on, you have the right to re-raise your self-defense claim. I think some of that case law might come into play. I don't know off the top of my head, but you can be the initial aggressor and then it can reinstate your right to self-defense. So I think there is case law that would
say. Why isn't this that case then?
I'm sorry?
Why isn't this that case then?
Because Mr. Rucker fired first. He fired before the gun was raised.
What do we do with the district court judge who sat through trial when she sentenced, imposed a mitigated sentence because she found that the victim was the aggressor?
So her role in that sentencing was very different. It was looking at the defendant as a person, not looking at the facts the way the jury did. And there is no case law saying if the judge makes a sentencing finding that discounts what the jury found. So we're in different realms there. And this is a case where a judge could find mitigating circumstances because everyone had a gun. This is a horrible, you know, accumulation of events. We have three people who are not allowed to have guns, who all have guns, who are in a highly populated area, and we have four shots fired.
So I'm trying to analyze these arguments. So this is a simple way of saying this. So what you're saying is, okay, Rucker fires, they're firing the two shots. At that time, they were obviously the instigator, and they should have left then. And that by hanging around long enough for the victim then to raise a gun, they kind of invited the victim. I mean, that's what I'm kind of getting. They kind of invited the victim to get into the gameplay. And I use the word play very in the sense that this is kind of a shootout. I mean, is that what you're saying? So it doesn't really flip on who was the aggressor at that point because it was initiated by Rucker, and to hang around long enough for somebody then to come after you diminishes the reverse of that?
I would generally agree with that, and it is complicated. Even trying to parse it out,
even trying to ask the question is complicated.
There are some cases that address this. I think cited in our brief specifically, there is Carradine is worth looking at because it's groups of people who knew each other who are all involved in this and where the self-defense claim.
Remind the panel, how did the judge instruct the jury?
In this case?
Yeah. I mean, on the aggressor issue.
Just the standard.
Okay, the standard
jig.
Okay.
There was no change to it.
Do we need to agree with you that the judge erred in not instructing on duty to retreat in order to affirm?
No, absolutely not. Because I think, as I said earlier, the state's strongest argument is that the jury didn't believe the defendant's testimony. The defendant was had the only evidence that he was subjectively afraid he was about to be killed.
Two follow-up questions. First, do you agree that Gardner supports the district court judge's decision not to instruct on duty to retreat?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I think it was the wrong decision, but that isn't before this court.
Well, I mean, couldn't you argue that's another reason to affirm? It's in the, you didn't cross appeal, but...
Well, I didn't... I would like a vehicle to challenge Gardner. That would be great.
Well, not to challenge Gardner, but to challenge the district court judge's application of Gardner.
If you look at the district court judges, she said it will just be cleaner. I think she was stepping away from how complicated this issue is by saying we're not going there. And she had a basis to do that. She could legitimately point to a case. I just don't think it's applicable. And there are cases where duty to retreat does apply in this exact situation in an urban confrontation with multiple people shooting. It's not the same as open fields in the frontier.
Can I just ask you, one other question is, why does what Mr. Rucker said, what he testified to, matter when we have direct evidence, we have video evidence, the victim charging at Mr. Rucker with the gun before the fourth and final shot is fired?
Because the second element of self-defense is subjective. The third element is objective. So it matters what the defendant thought, because that has to be reasonable, or it has to, from based on what he believes, it has to be reasonable for him to fire.
But I thought you've agreed that it's reasonable to fire when someone's running at you with a gun.
He has already fired twice by that point. That is absolutely important. He keeps firing. I would briefly address the prosecutorial misconduct claim. I think the strongest thing I can say is that the appellant cites to Garcia and says, as in Garcia, should be as in Rucker. And Garcia found that it was not, that it was plain error, but it was not sufficient to, didn't affect appellant's substantial rights. So I would ask for the same holding here as in Garcia.
Thank you.
I think Garcia, same as Garcia, same as Rucker, is on the prosecutorial misconduct and the substance of that. A couple things I just want to address really quickly. I want to be very, very clear that there is no evidence whatsoever in this record that Mr. Rucker was the instigator or that he was the initial aggressor. And I just want to make that clear, because the questions that were coming to the state seem to suggest that there's some confusion around what was Mr. Rucker's role. And there is no evidence. There was an exchange that's discussed in the state's brief. We can't see what's happening there. There's four people. Was it Mr. Rucker? Was it Mr. Watts? Was it the nephew? Was it DB? We have no idea. This is all guesswork or spitballing. The question on the testimony is a really important one. Did they believe his testimony or did they not? We will never know, and that's not our job to figure that out. But they don't need to believe his testimony to understand that there's a subjective fear that is about to, you know, there's subjective fear. We prove state of mind, intent all the time with circumstantial evidence. Because defendants don't have to take the stand, right? And so circumstantial evidence, in this case, it's direct evidence that shows DB was charging Mr. Rucker with his firearm up. Now, was Mr. Rucker supposed to wait? Was he supposed to wait until the fire was shot by the victim, by DB? That's too late. He can't wait. Otherwise, he will be dead. And so he was left with... Only one choice.
My question on the testimony was more factual, because your counterpart made a distinction between what you argued was I heard the shot and then I saw him fall versus I saw him get shot. And that's a pretty important difference, because the latter sounds a lot more like direct evidence to me.
The eyewitness testimony you're talking about, yeah. I'm sorry. To be very clear, the witness never said he saw him get shot. and we need to really look at the record there, and we put all of that in our briefing to be very clear, because this is a complex case with a lot of facts. And I think it's that kind of confusion about who was doing what, where, when, that may have, you know, troubled, you know, the jury. But then you have this prosecutorial misconduct, which said that DB may have had a self-defense claim. There's no basis for that in law, and there's no basis for that in fact. The prosecutor also excuse me, as I said, referenced that duty to retreat, and then he also said, misstating the evidence, and this is in our brief, that appellant brandished a gun. Appellant, there is no evidence that he brandished. We can guess maybe there might have been a brandishing, but there is no evidence. It's that off-camera incident where there was four people. Who knows what was going on there? The other point I want to make is on this jury receiving direct evidence of the shot. They just didn't. They didn't receive direct evidence.
Well, I'm looking at the testimony by the eyewitness, and he says he got shot and he dropped. That was his testimony.
Right.
I mean, you could say maybe he's inferring from, but there was no like lax. There was no an objection for lax foundation.
It's fair.
So I mean, the answer was, what I mean by it was over. He got shot and he dropped, and so that sounds like direct evidence. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, we raised this in a reply. Unless he had, I mean, it was dark. How do you see a flying bullet the dark?
That's the jury's province. There, you know, I mean. And if there's not a foundational objection and it's not stricken, then what are we to do with that?
What I would say was an eyewitness testimony saying he got shot. Well, he didn't. He said he was shot and then dropped. And he didn't say that I saw him got shot. I understand your point. This might be a point where we disagree on what that testimony means. I think the inference is that he was shot. He didn't see him actually get shot.
But the jury also had the ME's testimony about gunshot wounds, and the victim wasn't just shot through a blood vessel that then bled out. The bullet exploded a lot of internal organs also, as I understand the ME's testimony.
That's correct.
And so that's a little different than you get shot in the aorta and you bleed out over a period of maybe seconds or minutes.
It is fair, and the state made that point. The testimony remains that if you're shot, I mean, it could be that someone is, you know, able to continue moving about and then falls down. I see I'm out of time. I just want to say one last thing on the sufficiency of the evidence to address your concern. There is the possibility of, in the interest of justice, that this court decides. There's State v. Housley does look at the overall circumstances and takes in and can, in the interest of justice, find insufficiency. Our biggest concern is the self-defense and prosecutorial misconduct, though, as well. Thank you very much.
I want to compliment both counsel on the briefing in this matter as well as arguments. They're very helpful to this court, and we will certainly scour the record to make certain if there's any informational pieces that we may have stated incorrectly that we determine that. The matter is submitted. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame. Thank you for coming.